Hello and welcome to Tantramar Report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the heart of the Maritimes, the Sackville, New Brunswick, the traditional lands of the Mi'kmaq people, unceded in the Treaties of Peace and Friendship first signed with settlers in 1725. I'm Erica Butler. It's Tuesday, July 6th. Coming up on today's show, the province is introducing mobile drop-in vaccination clinics to help reach more New Brunswickers for first and second doses of COVID-19 vaccines. We chat with Sackville firefighter Laura Thurston about her request that Town Council personally read and discuss the results of a workplace assessment of the Sackville Fire Department. And cutting down forests can add up to big costs, according to a new report by Community Forests International. Meg Cunningham speaks with forest ecologist Megan DeGraff to find out more. But first, the COVID case update. There was one new travel-related case reported yesterday in the Fredericton region. With a few more recoveries, New Brunswick has 18 active cases of COVID-19 as of Monday. The last time the active case count was that low was in November of 2020, just before Zone 1 went into the orange phase. Four of the current active cases in the province are in Zone 1. No cases are currently under investigation. Nova Scotia also reported just one new case on Monday and now has 45 active cases of COVID-19. There have been no new cases in the Cumberland Health Network for about 1 month. Newfoundland reported 13 new cases on Monday, 12 of which are on a ship docked at Conception Bay. The province has 17 active cases of COVID-19. PEI is holding steady with one active case of COVID-19. Monday's vaccination numbers reflect a weekend slowdown with just over 5,500 doses administered, mostly to people getting a second dose. The rate of first doses is climbing very slowly. Currently, the three youngest eligible age groups, those 12 to 19, those in their 20s, and those in their 30s, have first dose vaccination rates ranging from 63 to 66%. That may change as the provincial government aims to improve accessibility and convenience of getting a vaccine shot. On Monday, the government launched a series of mobile vaccine clinics that will provide walk-in service with no appointment or scheduling required ahead of time. The clinics will take place at various times this week throughout the province, including one at the Bolorama in Dieppe on Saturday, July 10th. Since May, consultants from Moncton have been working on a comprehensive workplace assessment of the Sackville Fire Department. The assessment was commissioned after numerous allegations of bullying and sexism came to light in a series of stories by local journalist Bruce Wark. Last night at Sackville Town Council's July discussion meeting, one of Sackville's volunteer firefighters came to the virtual table with a request for mayor and councillors about what will happen to that consultant's report after it's completed. Here's Laura Thurston speaking at Monday night's council meeting.
To help avoid a potential conflict of interest and ensure the integrity of the information, I'm asking council to consider meeting, discussing, and approving obtaining the full detailed workplace assessment report and recommendations directly from Montana Consulting for both Sackville Fire and Rescue and the employees of the town. I believe approving this request will help firefighters and employees feel acknowledged and respected.
I spoke with Laura Thurston after her presentation at council to find out more about her request and the reasoning behind it. Laura Thurston, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Laura, you're a volunteer firefighter with the Sackville Fire Department. Tell us a bit about your background.
Born and raised in Sackville. My husband has been involved with the Sackville Fire Department for several years. And so it's always something I was interested in. And I've been with them now for 5 years.
Okay. So you, as a firefighter, would have been participating in this workplace assessment. That's going on right now with Montana Consulting. Tell us a bit about what your ask was at Monday night at council regarding that Montana Consulting workplace assessment.
Sure. After going through the interview process with Montana Consulting, I felt it important to speak with mayor and council about some of the questions that I had asked through that process and some of the answers that I had been given. With a new incoming mayor and some elected officials, I made my request a couple months ago to get council. And this was sort of the opportunity that came up once the new council and mayor had been sworn in. So I made a formal request. It was approved and I was added to the agenda. And essentially my request to council and mayor on Monday was because when I went through the process with Montana Consulting, I asked who receives the full report of sort of the collected information and the recommendations that will be made to sort of help solve some of these problems. And I confirmed with Montana Consulting at the time that the administrator of the workplace assessment on the town of Sackville side would receive that report. And then typically summarizations are given out as requested to mayor, council, et cetera. So the administrator for our workplace assessment is the chief administrative officer for the town. In matters of HR and issues of HR, typically we can expect or should expect sort of an unbiased, whatever you want to call it, like an unbiased review, let's say. In this case, I feel that the chief administrative officer being the administrator for the workplace assessment creates a conflict of interest because he is a direct chain of command official for the members of Sackville Fire and Rescue. He is one of the people that we go to, that we report to, that we, you know, deal with on a regular basis. So my request to council, and I feel it's very fair, is that they discuss, meet, and consider approving obtaining a full detailed report directly from Montana Consulting, not obtain that report from the chief administrative officer himself.
Right. So you don't want them to see a summary. You want them to see the full meal deal from Montana Consulting.
Exactly. I feel that that request being approved will help firefighters feel that they've been acknowledged, they've been respected.
Okay. Now, I guess, you know, part of the issue here has been that, I guess, there has been no recourse for these complaints from the fire department, right? This is one of the reasons, I guess, we're having this workplace assessment. The chain of command was pointed to as the proper sort of route to take these complaints, but that was tried, I gather, in some cases. Did you have the experience of trying to bring up issues that, you know, workplace issues that you had through the chain of command, but they just weren't getting addressed that way?
I did, yes. Personal experiences, for sure. Yes.
Okay. So that's, I guess, the main reason you feel it's a conflict of interest then in this situation, because you have tried that chain. You've tried, I guess, working with the CAO before and it didn't work. So is that the concern where the conflict of interest comes in?
Correct. I was absolutely denied to meet with him about my concern. And so this isn't a direct reflection on the chief administrative officer by any means, because we're all in this for a common goal, to make the fire department better, to make it the place that we all know that it can be, because the work that we do there is something that we're all very proud of and very passionate of, and we should be. So the common goal is to make it better, but the current system isn't working, and we know that, and that's common knowledge. It's not a secret. So when the system isn't working, we need to take action and we need to put things in place. So my expectation of the town, as they should expect from us, was to go into this with an open mind, to speak openly and to address our concerns, and then allow them to go through the process with Montana Consulting and come up with, Montana Consulting's going to provide recommendations, I guess, is sort of my understanding. But I think it's fair for us to expect an action plan in situations like this. And I feel that mayor and council, who employ the chief administrative officer for the municipality, should see that full report directly from Montana Consulting and have a bit of an independent discussion about the findings and the recommendations so that it can be unbiased.
Right. Yeah. And this is something that Montana Consulting, when you spoke with them, they indicated that this was something that is done occasionally. It's not unheard of that a council would ask to see the full report and have it not just go and stop at the CAO.
Correct. I asked specifically how that worked, because I asked who received the report, and they responded and told me the administrator for the workplace assessment received it. And I asked, so what happens if, you know, that report should be seen directly by mayor and council? And they said in other municipalities and in other assessments they've done, mayor and council employs the chief administrative officer, and therefore they do have the right to, in these situations, to approve and request report directly from them.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Mayor Michaud tonight, sort of, it wasn't totally clear to me what the answer was, but it seemed to indicate that he wanted to wait till the process as defined rolled out. And once they heard, you know, once they got what they were going to get from the CAO, or once they got their summary report, then he would make a decision after that. Is that what you got? What did you make of Mayor Michaud's answer to your request tonight?
I kind of understood it the same way. It was a very politically correct response, which is what I kind of anticipated. I'm not entirely upset with the response, because Mayor Michaud is correct. The work that Montana Consulting is doing isn't finished. But my request to council tonight wasn't to get an answer tonight. It was simply for them to know that this is my request, and it won't be the last time I speak with them about it. The one thing that I will be going back and reflecting on and speaking to council again about is, he did mention, and I believe he mentioned again during the question period, was that they would work with the CAO and wait and see what came out of the CAO's office. To me, I feel that that's unacceptable. I think that my request to get that report independently themselves is fair. And I would simply expect an answer as to why they don't feel that they can do that when it is possible. And to me, it makes me feel like we're being acknowledged and respected, and that they're taking this seriously. And we've been asked to take it seriously. So I think there's just expectations on both sides that hopefully that they will recognize.
All right. So would it be fair to say you're hoping that, you know, either that one of the counselors will put a motion on the table to sort of satisfy your request that they receive the report, do you think?
I hope so. To be honest, I'm not sure exactly how it could work, but if they don't sort of respond to that request, then I will make it again. I mean, I made my request early on purpose, so that when the work of Montana Consulting is finished and the recommendations have been made, when I speak again at council or we address this again, it's not coming to them as first time information. They can't say, oh, I wish you'd made this request sooner. I wanted to ensure that they knew where I stood and how I felt and what my expectations were going forward. I would encourage council to get out and speak to our members and to speak with town employees as well. But at the end of the day, that decision is on them. However, I want to see this through to the very end, and I hope that they are willing to do the same.
All right. You want to give us a hint of what your hopes are for this report and the recommendations that come out of it? What are your, you know, hopes and expectations?
Interesting question, because I don't have specific solutions. Definitely not something I'm qualified to do. But overall, I expect a collaboration between the officials of the town, their employees, and the firefighters based on the information and recommendations that come from Montana Consulting. I feel that we should be part of the discussion and part of the solution. Yes, we have to maintain confidentiality in HR matters, but at the end of the day, we're all to be working as a team. This is supposed to be something to make us all better and to make the fire department better and to make us a better workplace environment. So I don't want the work to stop at the report and recommendations. I expect to see an action plan. I want us to be part of the solution. I want to be part of the solution, and I would like the town to include us in that collaboration.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
That was Sackville volunteer firefighter Laura Thurston speaking with me on Monday night. Sackville Town Council will next meet Monday, July 12th at 7 p.m. for their regular monthly council meeting. Community Forests International is putting a price tag on deforestation. In a new report, CFI lays out how cutting down forests is ultimately very expensive for the province in the medium to long term, since woodlands are the best defense New Brunswick has against flooding. The research examines a plot of forest in the Cambridge Narrows area for a period of 3 years, a plot that CFI happens to own. Based on that study, the province would be on the hook for $1 million if the forest were to be cut down, since it would have to counteract the impact of flooding, among other ecological disruptions. That's almost three times what would be gained from cutting and selling the wood on the plot. Meg Cunningham spoke with forest ecologist Megan DeGraff to find out more.
The release had to do with how forests can help with flooding. And this province is super flood prone. I think we all have experienced a flood at least once. And how do forests help with flooding?
Well, at their most basic level, forests, when they are, you know, robust and healthy and standing and not being meddled with, they do a great job of slowing overland runoff, so water that flows over and through the land. They slow that water down, and they also act as a bit of a sponge, so they can slow it, hold it, and then release it slowly over time. When forests are removed, you see a change in that pattern of water moving across the landscape. So water tends to move more quickly, and so it doesn't get slowed down. And that's when you can have things like erosion and rutting and, destabilization of infrastructure, as well as things like stream banks. And then, of course, when you have really significant changes in water patterns, that's also when you can have flooding.
Right. I noticed that in the release, there's quite a bit of focus on the economic impact of flooding and providing an economic case for protecting forests. And I'm curious as to why the focus was on the money, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think we all know that trees and forests have an intrinsic value, right? They have a value for existing. They are valuable as organisms and for a number of things that they provide, a lot of different ecosystem services that they provide to us humans. But even if they didn't provide humans with anything, they'd still be valuable. But in terms of those ecosystem services that they provide, like air purification, spaces for recreation, habitats for animals that we might like to eat, or producing plants that we also might like to eat, you know, those kinds of ecosystem services, those can be valued in a way in the terms of money, so that they actually make the most sense to people, because a lot of people just don't have an understanding of those intrinsic values, but they can wrap their heads around what the value of something might be if there's a dollar figure put on it. Mm-hmm. And so specifically, people mostly can get their heads around a dollar figure when you put it in the context of loss. So if we tell people that a forest has this value for its ecosystem services, in, say, for example, in this case, their ability to slow water and to filter water, then if we can juxtapose that against the cost to people if that is lost, which is, you know, higher, mm-hmm. a higher cost to people, then that starts to ring bells, because people understand money and they understand the context of losing something costing you more money. There's been quite a lot of research done in general about the role in deforestation and water flow, and or different kinds of patterns with water, and all the way up to trying to figure out what kind of role does deforestation play in actual flooding. And of course, the answer is it's complicated, mm-hmm. because, you know, nature is complicated, and one watershed over here doesn't maybe act the same as a watershed over there. But by and large, there seems to be quite a lot of research that points to a relationship between deforestation and increased flooding, which to most of us just sort of makes common sense. Kind of go have a duh moment when you think about that. But nonetheless, that research has, you know, taken a long time to kind of be compiled and come together, and there's been a lot of debate over it. And we decided that we wanted to just dig in really deeply into one tiny piece of that story by looking at a very applied sort of science project on our own property that we own in Cambridge Narrows. So we own a 143-hectare parcel in Cambridge Narrows that is covered by absolutely spectacular mature forest, mixed Acadian forest. And it's a really magnificent example of the kinds of forests that used to be on the landscape here in the Maritimes, but that have largely disappeared. And there are some sort of remnant examples of those forests, and we just happen to have one on our parcel. Mm. So we wanted to really dig into what happens to the water pattern on this property when you compare standing old forest the way it currently is versus of like an imaginary or a modeled scenario where all of those trees get cut down and it becomes a clear cut. What does that do to the water? And that's what really drove us towards this hydrologic model. So what it looked like when I got up in the morning was really boring. We actually contracted out the hydrologic analysis to an engineering firm. So I sat at my computer and sent emails and fielded phone calls and, you know, talked about climate change scenarios and models and things like that with the engineers. It wasn't really all that exciting. Yeah.
Was curious, you studied forests that you happen to own, thankfully. Is there a particular forest that you are concerned about that has these flood reduction properties, or are you just doing the study to really emphasize how important it is to not deforest?
I just want to be really careful that we didn't, with our hydrologic analysis, we didn't look directly at flooding because flooding is caused by many factors. We just looked at one of those contributing factors. So, yeah, so what we were really curious about was, you know, if we have two different conditions, one is mature, healthy forest that we have on this property currently versus a projected scenario, like an imaginary scenario or a condition of no forest where it's been all cut off. But we looked at five different scenarios, including some intense storm events that would be sort of future looking with increased climate change. Mm. And because we wanted to look at the current, you know, kind of current intense storms that we're experiencing, rain events, I mean, and then also projecting forward a little bit to see what would happen under an increase of 20% or even 40% of additional rainfall in these intense storms. And what we found was even under the more moderate climate change scenario of an increase of 20% additional rainfall, we found that by clear-cutting this forest, we would have to build four catchment ponds of over 25,000 cubic meters of water to hold that amount of water to replace the sort of holding capacity of the current mature forest. So if we cut the forest down and we wanted to play the same ecosystem role of slowing and releasing, you know, holding and releasing water, we'd have to build catchment ponds that were equivalent to about 10 Olympic-sized swimming pools, which is huge. And not only that, to do so, it would cost us over $1 million, and that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Now, just to compare that, you know, if we in an imaginary scenario, clear-cut that forest, we'd get revenues from clear-cutting it mm-hmm. to the tune of about $285,000. But we'd have to turn around and spend $1 million to replace that water-holding capacity of that forest. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's not even taking into consideration that what happens to that water once it's released, you know, what happens if you don't, you know, if you just clear cut the forest, which is so often the case across this landscape, if you just clear cut the forest and don't build those catchment ponds, what happens to that water? Well, that water flows into the watershed, and depending on a whole bunch of other factors, that's when you can have contributions to flooding. You know, if it comes at a particularly bad time in a water cycle, or if there is a particularly bad storm event, or if there are particular other features of the watershed that are also contributing to flooding, mm-hmm. then that's one piece of the puzzle. So the case that we were making with this research was just that forests actually have more value standing. If you clear cut and get $285,000 for clear cutting this forest, but then you have to turn around and spend a whole bunch more, $1 million, to sort of replace that water retention role, then you're not further ahead. You haven't done yourself or your community any favors. And that's just looking at the water retention role, right? We didn't look at things like carbon storage, the value of carbon for climate mitigation. We didn't look at air purification services. We didn't look at the value of recreation or hunting or fishing or any of those other things that are all ecosystem services that have value too.
Okay. I'm curious, you have the report and it's, you know, anyone can go find it and read it, I assume. Is there anything else that's being done with this particular research or findings? Is it being sent to anyone or is it published just for the purpose of general knowledge?
Yeah, we do have, I mean, we're sort of in the last leg of this project right now, and our intention is to sort of sit and think for a bit about what the next phase will look like, and that will include, of course, finding funds to support another phase of this project. I think we're really interested in making a business case to the federal government for this kind of forest protection, and I think that kind of interest that interest will shape how we approach the next phase. At present, this report is kind of like our it is part of that business case. It makes the economics of it very clear in the report, and that's what we can use as we go into the next phase of fundraising and hopefully land securement, as in forest protection, mm-hmm. actively on the ground to make sure that more of these old forests aren't lost to clear cuts, because we recognize they have significant value.
That was Megan DeGraff, forest ecologist with Community Forests International. You can find a link to the full CFI report on chmafm.com. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar Report for this Tuesday, July 6th. As always, for story ideas, tips, or feedback, contact us at news@chmafm.com. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.